Well, hello and welcome to everyone to today's teleclass, I've Got You Under My Skin, Infection Control in Personal Service Settings. My name is Paul Weber, and I'm very glad you've made the time to join us today. I'm absolutely certain that it will be time very well spent. Dr. Bonnie Henry is a medical doctor and specialist in preventative medicine and in public health. She's the Director of Public Health Emergency Management for the British Columbia Centre for Disease Control. She is also Assistant Professor in the Division of Public Environmental and Occupational Health at the University of British Columbia. She has been a diving medical officer and flight surgeon for the Canadian Armed Forces. Dr. Henry worked for the World Health Organization on the Ebola outbreak in Uganda in 2000. And the Stop Polio program in Pakistan. She led the development of public health emergency management protocols for Ontario and was an executive member of the Ontario SARS Scientific Advisory Committee. It's a real honor to have her with us give this lecture. There are very few who are as qualified to do so. But before I let Bonnie take over, I'd like to acknowledge the support of Virox Technologies. Virox has been very good to teleclass education, and we are very grateful for their ongoing support. Thank you to everyone at Virox. Now, to present the teleclass, I've Got You Under My Skin, Infection Control in Personal Service Settings. From the BC Centre for Disease Control, I am delighted to introduce Dr. Bonnie Henry. Bonnie.
Good morning. Good morning. And it is morning still out here in BC, and we were talking earlier, heard some voices about the weather, and it's a beautiful sunny day out here, and the cherry blossoms are out on the trees, so I'll rub that in. It's nice to hear some familiar voices out there as well, so welcome. And I hope I can give you some interesting discussion around personal service settings and some of the experiences that we've had. I certainly had an interest in this for a long time. As Paul mentioned, I was in the military in my former life as a medical person, and there's a long tradition of tattooing in the military, particularly sailors, pirates, and navies. So I had some interesting experiences with some people who had tattoos in many places, and it really became an interest of mine. And since that, working in public health, there's a whole variety of other personal service settings which can cause some pretty severe infections, and I think we'll run through some of those today. So next slide. The objectives of the talk today are really to define what are personal service settings and describe some of the potential infectious risks associated with them and some of the interesting outbreaks that have happened over the last few years. And we're going to review those outbreaks with a detailed example of an acupuncture-related outbreak that I was involved in when I worked at the City of Toronto. And people from York Region, I heard you on the line, will recognize some of this as well, I'm sure. Then we're going to review some of the infection prevention and control issues for personal service settings and to describe some of the programs and really what I think is a need for us to ensure the buyer beware and to increase awareness in the public about the things that they should look for. And I was writing this and putting this presentation together a couple weekends ago when I had the wonderful opportunity to be at a lovely spa with my sister, and we walked through some of the infection control procedures that we're going through at the time. So next slide. What are personal service settings? And that's a term that's used in many different places. But the key ones really are tattoo parlors, nail salons, manicures and pedicures particularly, and then places that provide a whole wide range of services that involve something to do with either piercing the skin or touching the skin. So acupuncture, body piercing, which has become incredibly popular over the last 2 to 3 decades, electrolysis, waxing, branding, which apparently has increased in popularity as well over the last little while, aesthetics, which are things like permanent makeup, and just this morning, for example, the MMWR from the United States put out a report about unlicensed practitioners injecting soft tissue fillers, which are really enhancers for lips, breasts, buttocks. And in this case, these unlicensed practitioners with no medical training had led to some really severe adverse events, and they had injected what was supposed to be liquid silicone, and there was 3 cases of severe renal failure requiring dialysis related to this. So it really is something that is an ongoing and moving target. as well hairdressing and barber services, although they tend to be much lower risk. And indeed, some of the occupational health risks around hairdressing services and barber services are maybe more important. So next slide, what are the infectious risks that we're concerned about? With any personal care procedures that involve puncturing the skin, we need to consider these a risk for bloodborne pathogens, and certainly that has become a much more important consideration over the last, since the mid-80s, really. And hepatitis B, hep C, and HIV are the three big ones that we're always concerned about. And way back into the 80s, hepatitis B transmission has been documented from a variety of personal service settings, including acupuncture, basic ear piercing, when the type of gun that's used can allow blood to collect behind the bolt that puts the earring through. Tattooing definitely has been a source of hepatitis B and C infection around the world, and I have had some experience looking at tattoo parlors in many parts of the world in my naval days, and the levels of hygiene and reuse of needles is really shocking at some times. An interesting one, in 1990, there was an outbreak of hepatitis B related to jet injections at a weight loss clinic, so they were injecting medications into these people to help them lose weight. There's certainly been a number of body piercing related hepatitis B transmissions, including both licensed and commercial settings, as well as unlicensed practitioners who set up in fairs and malls and things. Hepatitis C has definitely been shown to be transmitted. There's much less evidence about HIV, but there has been at least one documented case related to piercings, and we know that there's likely been cases, although they may not have been documented in the literature. But bloodborne pathogens really are only part of the story. They're often what trigger concern about infection prevention and control in these settings, and it really is the bloodborne pathogens that made us think that we need to do something about regulating or monitoring these professions. So the next slide, I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the other infectious risks and look at some of the specific things that may be associated with them. So the other infectious risks that have been documented, piercing has been associated with multiple infections, including bloodborne pathogens. But the recent trend of body piercings other than ears has increased the risk with site-specific issues, including urethritis for piercings that go through the glands, penis, mastitis, certainly abscesses in various places. And the primary really concern is getting clean, good quality jewelry that's inserted in the right place. And I just want to talk a little bit more about body piercings because I think it's very interesting. And really, it's very popular, and if it's done right, it apparently people do it because they like the look of it, and it apparently increases sensations in certain areas. But there's some caveats. So piercing has been around for a long time. In almost every society as far back as possible that we can trace, there's been mostly facial piercings, so ear piercings, nose piercings, mouth piercing, except for a very few tribes, like, for example, in Borneo, there's a traditional piercing of the glands penis with a bone, and mention of penis jewelry in the Kama Sutra. But other than that, piercings of nipples, genitals, and other areas of the body is really largely a new and Western phenomenon. And the popularity really increased in the 1970s, and a lot of the sort of mythology around piercing probably is actually not true. So there was a piercer in a guy named Jim Ward in the United States who started a magazine around piercing to increase the popularity and to make sort of romanticize. So a lot of the stories and myths are attributed to him, and he apparently made these up to make it more acceptable to people. For example, there's a longstanding story about Prince Albert, the Queen Victoria's consort, that he wore a penis ring to avoid bulges in the pants. And apparently that is not actually true. It was made up around the 1970s to increase the romanticism around this. Although there was some reports of Victorians in the Victorian area writing in their diaries about nipple rings. there's a lot of concern, particularly in the 80s and early 90s, about piercings being a sign of delinquent behavior. And particularly in the medical profession, which tends to be pretty conservative, we often look sideways at people with multiple piercings, although I think it's become a lot more acceptable in the last little while. An interesting study in the magazine Body Art, so these are people who are really into this stuff, of the 134 of their readers, the most common reason for getting a piercing is because they like the way they looked. So it's not a sign of belonging to a certain group or trying to be rebellious in certain ways for many people. Interestingly, almost 80% of them were over 30, and about half, a little over, well, two-thirds were married or in long-term relationships. So I think our ideas around who gets piercings and why has changed quite dramatically. And really the important thing for piercings and for what we see and for the public health aspects of infection prevention and control, you want clean, good quality, and well-positioned jewelry, and it has to be the correct shape for the area, and I think this is something that we don't necessarily know a lot about. And it also needs to be thick enough. One of the things, if you have it too thin or poor quality, it acts like a cheese wire, which is kind of a gruesome analogy, but it can actually work its way through the skin and cause a lot of irritation, be a source of infection. So really, piercings work best if they're short and if they're in a body part that doesn't move around a lot. So earlobes work really well. They're fairly short. They don't change position when you move, and they tend to be pretty stable. Whereas navel piercings, for example, are often prone to failure because the navel is a bit longer area, and if you don't have the right size and the right shape of jewelry, it can work its way out, and it can take a long time to heal and can be an ongoing source of irritation and infection. All right, so enough about piercings then. Those are just some interesting background. I hope you find it interesting. So the next slide, the infectious risks are really myriad. So tattooing and piercing, I have some slides up there of a fairly recent outbreak of MRSA that was related to 44 unlicensed tattoo artists in Ohio, Kentucky, and Vermont, and this was reported in the MMWR in 2006. And really, some very nasty infections related to improper use of needles. So everything from warts, primary inoculation of tuberculosis under the skin, Mycobacterium abscessus, which I'll talk a little bit more about, molluscum contagiosum. Some of the more severe infections are with organisms gram-negatives and organisms like Pseudomonas. Certainly there's been multiple documentations of transmission of herpes through improperly sterilized either needles or the ink pots. So reuse of ink pots can be a source of infection. As well, there has been cases in the literature of sepsis and toxic shock related to procedures that have been improperly sterilized, including, although rare, death and bacterial endocarditis. And a very interesting one I found where a subcutaneous zygomosis, so a fungal infection, was injected through a piercing by a very unusual organism that was very difficult to eradicate and required extensive plastic surgery correction. So these risks are very real, and they're also can be quite damaging and permanent in some cases. So next slide. So to move on from the interesting piercings and tattooings to the more mundane in some ways, manicures and pedicures. These are things that are quite common. I mean, many of us have them. And there's less evidence for transmission of bloodborne pathogens, but it's still possible, particularly if people are still doing things like shaving off calluses with a razor. And certainly there was a case of fatal sepsis after a foot cut that led to infection from this that's in the literature. Things like clipping of cuticles instead of pushing them back can lead to small cuts and abrasions that will be a source for infection. But most commonly we see paronychia, so infection of the nail bed, cellulitis around areas, and fungal infections. The usual suspects for the skin infections, of course, are staph and strep, but we can now see community-associated resistant strains or actually people passing fungus from one nail to the next within on their own foot from improperly cleaned instruments in between things. So I've put in here an interesting picture, a very sad picture actually, of a young girl who was involved in a large outbreak of Mycobacterium fortuitum in multiple states in the U.S. And there was a couple of young people in Illinois who initially presented with the infection. And when they started looking at risks, they found that over 100 women from California and Illinois particularly were infected with this Mycobacterium. And it was related to improperly cleaned foot baths in a nail salon. So many places that we know, especially manicures, pedicures, hair salons, are not monitored by public health. Very few are inspected regularly. And that was one of the issues that came up in this report of the foot baths in the nail salons. Some parts of the world, they are licensed and there are inspection programs. In some parts, there aren't. So the next slide, once this Mycobacterium infections were noticed, there was a much more detailed investigation of, you know, what was it around these foot baths that was leading to this infection. And what they found, that these were contaminated with a whole variety of Mycobacterium, not surprisingly, and there's a list of them there from the report that came out in Emerging Infectious Diseases a couple of years ago. One of the things they found was that there were no cleaning and disinfection guidelines, and that many of these foot baths in nail salons, and I put a picture of one up there, drained incompletely, or they would get a lot of buildup of material in the bottom in the little basket that catches the drain, and that they weren't being cleaned, and that was most often the source of infection. So there's a number of guidelines that have now come out around cleaning of foot baths and structures, so how the foot bath should be built so that it drains completely, that it gets disinfected regularly, cleaned between everybody and disinfected, and then more extensive cleaning and clearing of the trap nightly. A couple of other things that really came out with the manicure and pedicure issue was things like, if you don't shave for 24 hours before you go in, you're much less likely to have a source of infection, because shaving does cause small cuts and irritations of the skin. And you need to ensure that people are using sterilized instruments. So next slide. There are infectious risks of other things that are done in salons and spas, including waxing, which is, as anybody who's had it knows, ripping the hair out certainly leaves the skin vulnerable. And there's a couple of things that have been shown in the literature to be associated with waxing. So most commonly is folliculitis, and often it's just an irritative folliculitis, but it can also be an infection that leads to abscesses as well. Herpes simplex, molluscum contagiosum, fungus, and interestingly, human papillomavirus have all been documented to be transmitted through waxing. And the real most common mistake, like at the buffet table, is double dipping. So people who use the wax stick, spread the wax on the skin, and then replace the stick and reuse the stick in the pot of wax, and then use the same pot of wax between people. So not redoing the same area helps protect the skin, and not double dipping is a really important message around waxing. All right. So the next slide, I'm going to talk a little bit about an outbreak that we were involved in Toronto, and it was actually extended to a number of the surrounding health units as well. And this was an outbreak related to acupuncture. And at the time, I was the medical officer of health in the city of Toronto, or one of the medical officers of health, and I got a call from a dermatologist pathologist who worked at one of the hospitals. And she reported that she saw a cluster of unusual skin infections, which is fabulous. It's nice to know that our people who see something unusual are willing to and know who to call in public health. And so she had seen two individuals herself when she works as the dermatology part of what she does in a clinic. And then she had received two pathology specimens in the pathology lab that she worked in. And all of the specimens seemed to have a Mycobacterium infection. And at the time, she wasn't quite sure, but it was likely to be Mycobacterium abscessus. And the two patients that she had seen herself both mentioned receiving acupuncture. And she knew that the two that she had seen had the same acupuncturist. And on the requisitions for the other two, there was also mention of having had acupuncture. So next slide. Well, what is Mycobacterium abscessus? It's an atypical bacteria. It's commonly found in the environment, but it rarely causes human illness. And we know that we can find it if we look in many sources of water, for example. Unless you have a pathway, a direct inoculation into the body, it's very unlikely to cause illness. And obviously the host immune system is part of the way that we are able to fight it off. But it can be transmitted, and there's been many documented cases, through wounds or via injectable medications or medical devices. Next slide. The thing about Mycobacterium abscessus is that the incubation period can be quite long, up to a year in some cases, and certainly that was one of the issues that we ran into in this investigation. Although every age is at risk, you need to have some sort of means of introducing the bacterium, or you can have more severe infection, as with many things in immunocompromised individuals. And interesting with Mycobacterium abscessus is that resistance to multiple antibiotics is very common, and certainly that was the case in this outbreak as well. So the next slide shows a not very clear picture, but a picture of some of the skin sores or abscesses that can be caused by Mycobacterium abscessus. Usually these are ulcerative lesions with a lot of discharge. It can also have some systemic effects, including fever and chills. And treatment, as with many Mycobacterium, can last for a long time. So antibiotics, often antibiotics in combination that need to be taken for up to 6 months. But these are not minor infections. These are not just a little bit of skin irritation. And I have some more pictures of the cases that we saw in this outbreak coming on. And certainly in our case as well, we realized that there was quite a high level of resistance in the infection that we were seeing. So the next slide, and I have to, it's called the skinny on the investigation, and I need to credit to Manali Varia, who's a field epidemiologist at the time who was working with us on this, for coming up with these great titles. So the health unit interviewed these four patients, and then we spread word to through doctors and patients, particularly dermatologists and some of the physicians who worked in the area. We identified another 7 people who had similar infections and had had acupuncture, all at the same clinic. So one of the things that we were able to do was we conducted an inspection of the acupuncture clinic. And this is something that is can be controversial in some areas. Acupuncture was not a regulated health profession in Ontario at the time, so it could fall under public health jurisdiction. But that can be very tricky in some areas. If it is a regulated health profession, then the profession itself has some responsibility and in many cases has some authority to inspect for infection control issues. However, they may not have people who are experienced in doing that, and so there needs to be a close relationship between public health and the colleges to ensure that appropriate infection prevention and control measures and inspections are done. In this case, we conducted an inspection of the acupuncture clinic at one site and came to realize or found out through talking with patients that there's actually 2 clinics. And that was even trickier because the second site that this person worked at, this acupuncturist worked at, was out of her home. And there are some very interesting legal jurisdictional issues about inspections and invading someone's privacy in their home. One of the things that we identified very early on was that there was reuse of improperly sterilized needles in that clinic. And we were able to, using the public health legislation, direct the acupuncturist to stop treatments. And because we weren't sure how many people were infected and because we were seeing Mycobacterium abscessus infections, but knowing that sterile procedure was not being followed appropriately, we decided to do a trace back on all clients who had seen at that clinic for about a year beforehand. And this was really because we were concerned about transmission of bloodborne pathogens as well. So who has the authority to inspect is also is an important and often controversial issue. So our next slide. This is a little bit more on the investigation. We sent out a letter to all of the clients that we were able to see or to determine had seen this acupuncturist. And here's another issue that we ran into was that the acupuncturist did not keep very good records of who she was seeing and how we could contact them. So we advise them of the very low but possible risk of bloodborne pathogens. So, and we advise them to be tested for hepatitis B, C, and HIV. And we also ask them if they had any concerns with skin infections. And we made arrangements for them to be assessed. The acupuncturist was served with a legal order under the public health legislation to stop practice until remedial infection prevention and control course could be taken, and she could demonstrate to us that she understood the principles of infection control and would be using them appropriately. Interestingly, this person was a quite well-trained acupuncturist, and we had some pretty detailed discussions with acupuncture training programs, including there's a school in Toronto that teaches traditional Chinese medicine and acupuncture, and they really have a very detailed and a very good program around infection prevention and control for acupuncture settings. And they really stress, I mean, it is the standard of practice within their organization that you don't reuse needle, reuse needles. But they had no way of policing this or ensuring that people adhere to those standards. Interesting, well, as well, at least in my mind in this case, was that she had worked in Quebec for a number of years prior to this, and acupuncture is a regulated health profession in Quebec. So we were able to follow up and find out if there had been concerns or complaints or outbreaks related to her practice in Quebec, and we had not found any concerns prior to this, which was a bit reassuring. So we sent pretty detailed information packages to all of the clients that we found that were seen at that acupuncture clinic and advised them to where they could get information about this and to let us know if they had skin infections. So next slide. We came up with an outbreak case definition, as we would in these situations. So a suspect case was somebody who had a skin infection at needle insertion sites lasting more than 2 weeks and had attended either one of the two acupuncture clinics, one in her home and the other in the physician office, or other in an office that, interestingly for us, was another legal hoop, was located within a physician's office but was a separate practice from the physician practice. A probable case was somebody who had a Mycobacterium abscessus infection diagnosed by a physician, and a confirmed case, obviously, is one with laboratory isolation of Mycobacterium abscessus. So in our next slide, we identified 168 clients that we could find that had been seen in the clinic in the period of time we were concerned about. About 32 of them reported having lesions, so 19%. And of those, the majority were probable or lab-confirmed cases, and some of them were suspect cases. The whole dynamic around this was really quite interesting because people, despite the fact that these lesions followed the tracks of where the acupuncture had been, many of them didn't believe that it had anything to do with the acupuncture, and certainly the acupuncturist who had been seeing people with these lesions in her office was telling them that it had nothing to do with her services that she had provided. And it was quite an interesting dynamic amongst the group. Some people clearly were terribly upset and had long-term issues with the infection. The next slide shows our epi curve, so the epidemic curve. There was the cases that came to light for us were the first confirmed case and a couple of probable cases and a suspect case in July. But in traceback, we found one person who had almost a year previously similar infections that met our case definition. So next slide, and looking at the epidemiology, the median age of the cases was 49 years, so range from 22 to 81, and as is likely to be the population that sees an acupuncturist, the majority of them were female. There were some males involved, but a small number. And the majority of the people who went to the acupuncturist were female, so this was really a representation of her patient population. In terms of health units around Ontario, most of the cases were in Toronto, although there were some cases up in York Region, in Peel, and in Durham, so all the surrounding health units. So this person had a quite a vibrant practice and had a lot of people coming in from different places to see her, including one case who was a woman who ended up moving to North Carolina but had returned and used to see her for acupuncture when she had to come back to Toronto for business. Next slide. The median incubation period for the 22 patients that we could figure this out for was about a month, but it ranged from a couple of weeks to 5 months. And it took another about 3 months for most people before they received a correct diagnosis. So many of them had gone back to their acupuncturist, had gone to the family doctor, and eventually had been referred to either an infectious disease specialist or a dermatologist. And before they had the correct diagnosis, and of course some of them didn't seek medical attention until they received information from public health asking whether they had these infections. Skin biopsies were done on 23 of the patients, and 21 had granulomatous inflammation, two with nonspecific inflammation, and acid fast bacilli were observed in one of the specimens. So if we go to the next slide, continuing with the epidemiology, it takes a long time to grow Mycobacterium, as we know from tuberculosis, but also Mycobacterium abscessus takes some time. So it took, on average, 17 days for the cultures to be isolated. And then in terms of resistance, interestingly, all of them were susceptible to clarithromycin, which is nice because it's a relatively easy antibiotic to take and it works very well, with very few side effects. But there was multiple resistance to a variety of other antibiotics. So that was interesting, including the resistance to sulfamethoxazole, which is part of a commonly used medication for skin infections. And all of them had the same AFLP pattern, so we really were quite confident that these cases were linked. And if you look at the next slide, that shows the AFLP typing, so that's the slide that demonstrates that these were all of the same strain. So moving on, the next slide again, the clinical picture. So of the 24 patients that we dealt with in some detail, 9 of them had 10 or more lesions. So these were quite, you know, they had a lot of these lesions. All were on sites of the previous acupuncture. Almost all of them had lesions on their lower extremities, which is an interesting point that I'll come back to in a minute. And about two-thirds had lesions, or three-quarters had lesions on upper extremities as well, and half on the trunk. Now, interestingly, in treatment, 16 people received appropriate antibiotic therapy, and of those, 15 took more than six months or more of clarithromycin before they were cleared of the infection. One case took 3 months of oral azith, and that seemed to work. And a couple of them didn't take longer than 30 days of clarithromycin for a variety of reasons. A couple of people used naturopathic topical therapy, and some even declined therapy. Most of these cases were people who really didn't believe that acupuncture was the cause of this and weren't that concerned about it, even though having seen some of the lesions, they were quite dramatic. But I guess it depends on what your concern is. And so the next slide shows some of the lesions, and as you can see, they're not small, and they were in some cases purulent, draining for a period of time. So 23 patients that we knew of had clinical resolution. One person continued to have active lesions even after 12 months of therapy and was very distressed by it. And all of the people that we followed up had all 24 had residual scarring or hyperpigmentation in the area. So this was something that would stay with them for a long time, if not for life. We did, a variety of people were tested, actually majority of them were tested for Hep B, C, or HIV. I don't know why I put Hep A in there. not a big issue in this case. Anyway, and there were no seroconversions that we were aware of. And not surprisingly, the next slide, there was a fair amount of media around this because it was felt to be, you know, people think of holistic and acupuncture as part of a holistic medicine that is natural and therefore safe. And they sometimes are shocked by the fact that you can actually get infections from things that are felt to be quite risk-free. So the media reported on this extensively. The acupuncturist initially, and you know, we tried to protect her confidentiality, but her patients were quite vocal in talking to the media, and some of them, of course, were extremely upset, and there was a lawsuit, a couple of legal actions taken against the acupuncturist, and I don't think those have even finished yet. So we did have to put out a public notification because it was very difficult to identify all the clients that she had seen over the period of time that we were concerned about. And really, the message that we tried to get out through the media was there's risk associated with all of these things and that you really need to be careful and be aware. So the next slide, in terms of contamination sources and, you know, where this happened and how we, what kind of could have happened at this acupuncture clinic, one of the inspection that we did showed that there were reusable needles being used. They were sterilized between clients using a small autoclave that she had purchased, but the autoclave was broken, wasn't working very well. She also sterilized them using a chemical sterilant between clients, but this chemical sterilant was improperly constituted. It was one of the ones that was supposed to be used 100%, and she had diluted it to about 30% mixed with tap water, which was clearly inappropriate. As well, her patients reported that she placed the sterile needles in a glass jar containing cotton balls, and actually it was filter material from fish tanks, so a cotton material that is used as a filter in fish tanks. And she put that in a jar with a little bit of tap water and put the needles in that prior to using them in a patient. And that was reported by a variety of the patients. Initially, she had denied doing that, but we found the material in her office, and she had agreed that she did do that. As well, her patients have told us that she would take individual sterilized needles, that single-use needles, and would put them in this jar with the solution prior to using them. So she'd take them out of the sterile package, and she told a couple of her clients that this was to ensure that they were clean. One of the other things that we went through with her in terms of infection practices in her practice was, you know, how did she do the acupuncture? And standards from the acupuncture colleges that we talked to said that you should start on the upper extremities and move down towards the lower extremities. And that was, she tended to start at the feet and then would reuse the needles up the legs and into the trunk and onto the face and arms of the patient. So our next slide here, the role of public health. Infection prevention and control in the community, and this is one case of that where we are involved in outbreak investigations, investigations of complaints, and I think public health around the world where we have regulation like this are involved in complaints of all sorts of settings, including personal service settings. We do have the mandate to investigate all reportable diseases, and although Mycobacterium abscessus is not reportable, a cluster of unusual cases or cases of an unusual infection fit into the legislation in every province in Canada, certainly as being something that public health has a mandate to investigate. We obviously try to identify cases, contact tracing, sources of the infection, and with the intent of reducing risk, and to provide overall education and information or assistance both to clinicians and to the public around these issues and the risk. So in terms of surveillance, we do ongoing monitoring and data collection and reporting at both the provincial or state and national level, and the footprint bath outbreak that I mentioned earlier is really a classic example of a cluster of cases in a few states, people communicating between states and leading to an outbreak detection that really was national. The other example that I mentioned earlier as well was the MRSA and the tattoo parlors, and a multi-state investigation when people started seeing these unusual infections led to the identification of a number of unlicensed tattoo parlors where this was being spread. And next slide. The other things that we're involved in, of course, are prevention and trying to identify a hazard before it causes a problem. And there is legislation in all provinces of Canada and in most parts of the world that gives public health, the environmental health side of what we do, the legal authority to investigate what are often called health hazards. And complaints would fall into that. We do restaurant inspections. There's a variety of settings that we can do this in. some areas of the country, including Ontario, have inspection programs for personal service settings. And in Toronto, we had set up a fairly extensive program to try and identify higher risk settings and to provide infection prevention and control information, inspection of premises, and with a view to trying to increase awareness and understanding among practitioners of why they need to be careful about infection control and the things that they need to do within their own facility to or site to ensure that they don't pass on infections to their clients. The next slide. We do have the authority under legislation, a medical officer of health or a public health inspector, if we think a hazard exists, and that was the legislation we used in this case, to order somebody to do something or stop doing something, the requirements is necessary, to decrease the effect of or to eliminate the health hazard. So those were, it's fairly broad powers to try and limit the impact and to mitigate the effects of health hazards on the public. Next slide. I'm going to talk a little bit about regulation of acupuncture just because it was an issue in this case, and it can be a complicating factor in many of the personal service settings. So puncturists are a regulated health profession in BC, Alberta, and Quebec, and after this outbreak have become regulated in Ontario just this past year. But the things that we found that we had difficulties with in Toronto and in many other places, if you read in the literature, it's the same. There's a problem of identification of premises. You know, what is a personal service setting? If we go back to the second or third slide I showed, there's a variety of different settings. And it's very difficult, one, to find places, because anybody, if there's not a regulated profession, anybody can call themselves an acupuncturist or a traditional Chinese medicine practitioner or an esthetician or a tattooist or a piercer. It's very difficult to try and monitor how people are doing and what they're doing and to ensure that they maintain a certain standard. One of the things that we do have working for us is that most of them need to be licensed, or there is a requirement in most places that they require a license for practicing of a business license. And however, we know that many, many businesses are temporary, or there, for example, we had a person who was giving tattoos at a weekend fair for a variety of, this was about a year after this acupuncture outbreak, and there was risk of transmission of bloodborne pathogens and at least one case where we feel that the person was probably exposed to hepatitis B through this weekend fair. So, you know, really, tattooing is not something that should be done on the street corner, and is not and it can be very risky if people are not trained in how to do things appropriately. And it's really difficult to know what services are provided at each site. Certainly when we were looking at our personal service settings program in the City of Toronto, we started with, you know, the phone book, and we talked to the city about where licensed premises were, but they tend to move around a lot, and you're not sure if they're just doing hair cutting or whether they're doing piercings or whether there's different types of piercings done in different places. And, you know, just this MMWR I mentioned this morning, you know, these soft tissue fillers, They're supposed to be silicone, but they in unlicensed places often happen in salons where they do this on the side, or in people's homes where they provide this. And they may use agents that are not designed for medical use, like regular mineral oil or flaxseed oil, and the infections that these can cause have been documented, and they can be quite severe. And so our next slide, in Toronto, we put together a compliance inspection for personal service settings, and this is just some examples based on the Toronto program. So inspection for compliance to infection control for acupuncture, things like washing your hands before and after, glove use, wearing new disposable gloves for each client, cleansing the skin with an antiseptic, using disposable needle, and really the standard of practice in Canada and in most of the Western countries should be single-use, prepackaged, sterile, disposable, and individually wrapped needles. And they need to, the client needs to know that as well. That needles need to be discarded into a sharps container. That was a common thing that we found, that places did not dispose of things appropriately, and the same goes for tattooing and for many other settings as well. the types of instruments used. For example, I mentioned earlier the ear-piercing guns. We've known there's been known transmission from blood that's collected behind the pin of bloodborne pathogens related to ear piercing. For tattooing, having disposable needles, but also disposable ink pots, extremely important because when you're re-dipping the needle in to apply the tattoo, you can contaminate the ink pots. The next slide is just some general in compliance issues for personal service settings, so things like laundering of linens and towels between clients, adequate lighting, work services, and these are no stranger to people who work in infection control, work services, surfaces that can be cleaned appropriately, cleaning and disinfection between clients and on a routine basis as well. Maintaining client records. This is a big issue in many places where they don't maintain records of who gets tattoos, who gets piercings, who gets other higher risk activities. And there is requirements to maintain records for a year. One of the ones that I didn't put on here, which is a really key one and one that we spent a lot of time working on, was you have to have hand washing facilities. And alcohol-based hand rubs are adequate for some places, but hand washing is important in others. And the number of particularly hair salons or other places that didn't have adequate hand washing facilities, not hair salons, I'm sorry, but piercing places that didn't have hand washing facilities really shocked me. You know, people who do ear piercing in a little booth in the mall without a hand washing facility, that to me, that was a common thing that we saw. All right. So next slide. So for all personal service settings, it's interesting. There's a couple of studies out there that have looked at particularly tattooists, because that has tattooing and piercing has been, as I mentioned, associated with a variety of different infections. And in many places, they've been looking at owners and operators and the tattoo artists themselves, how good they are at understanding infection control. And it was an interesting study from Australia which really showed that a low percentage of staff understood the purpose of disinfection and sterilization and the whole reason why they had to do these measures. And they all reported that their compliance could be improved, and they actually reported that they didn't think public health inspected frequently enough, which I thought was interesting. And it was certainly reflected in our program in Toronto when we initially started it. There was a lot of resistance to having us come in and inspect. But once we started the program and people realized that this was an advantage to them and to their customers and helped protect their clients from things and made them more professional and more accountable for their work, they embraced it and felt it was a really good program, particularly the education portion of the program, where they were given instructions around infection control, and the compliance inspection form itself was really helpful to help them look at what areas they could improve within their own shop. Interestingly, or not surprisingly, there were deficiencies observed around washing of hands, wearing of gloves, sterilization procedures, and a U.S. study really echoed the same results. But I thought it was interesting. They showed that the longer you were a tattooist, those with over 10 years of experience did worse on the infection control compliance audits. So either that means that your bad habits increase over time, or they just never had the training and that the newer tattooists had. So next slide. I think there's a couple of things, and I've mentioned this a couple of times. We need to focus some public health efforts at increasing infection prevention control measures within these settings, but also we need to educate the public that there's things that they need to do or look for that will help protect them from infection as well. So one of the big ones, I think, it's really important, make sure the shop owner, the operator that you're going to get these procedures done is licensed. It's a key requirement that ensures that they at least meet the basic requirements for having cleanliness protocols, having hand washing, whatever. So don't go to the temporary tattooist who works at the fair outside and doesn't have a hand washing facility. And you know, many of the more recent infections that have been related to personal service settings have been in unlicensed premises, as the licensed premises and the operators of licensed premises tend to be more and more involved in understanding the reasons why they need to do these measures. So don't get a service if you have or suspect you have a skin infection, particularly on your legs. And you need to be very concerned if you have diabetes or eczema about the types of services that you get. And this applies to pedicures and manicures and other services as well. Telling people not to shave for 24 hours before the appointment. Shaving really does result in nicks or cuts, which can be pathways for infection. Look around the salon. It should be clean, free of trash, set up with clean instruments, and these sound pretty self-explanatory to us. But you know, people don't think about this, and we need to remind them that it is important for them to look for a clean environment. And they should have hand washing facilities. In the next slide, if you're having a pedicure, we now know from the foot bath incidents that you should look carefully and make sure there's no standing water in the foot bath, and that if it's being drained, ask that it be cleaned and disinfected, or ask what the procedures are for that. I looked at a number of blogs online when I was putting this together, and along with the literature search, there's some really interesting information about tattooing and piercings. And the tattooists, the people who get tattoos and piercings, particularly the ones who get a variety of them, are really big on this. And they have put out a lot of messages around asking people about infection control procedures. And they say, you know, this is an important thing. If you're getting a tattoo, it's permanent. And it's painful, and it's going to cause problems, it's going to irritate your skin, and you don't want to get infected. So they say ask the technician about what they do for infection control. And if they don't care about it, if they don't care to talk to you about it, or if they're embarrassed about it, then you don't want to get your tattoo there, because this is, you want your tattoo from somebody who cares about how it's going to look, whether it's going to look nice but also that you're not going to get sick because of it. And looking for technicians who are not smoking, eating, et cetera, while performing a service. And you know, that kind of shocks you when you think about things. But there's many, many places where people may not have the same level of sanitation that we expect. And one of the key things is if you have any doubts about the cleanliness of the premise or their adherence to basic sanitation measures, then go somewhere else. And that's a message I think we need to get out to people. When we talk to people about why they go to unlicensed premises and why they get these tattoos at the fair on the Saturday afternoon, and many places now people find them on the internet, and it's the most common reason they go to unlicensed places is because it costs less. But there's a risk you're taking when it costs less. And so finally, the next slide, our conclusions there, as I think we've presented, there are real infectious risks in personal service settings. In some areas, there are regulations and public health inspection and prevention programs, but even the best ones can't keep up with the changing services, with unlicensed operators, which are outside the scope of our ability to find them. And so users of the services need to be aware of the risks and take precautions as well. And it's part of our responsibility in public health to get the message out to people about what the risks are and what the precautions are that they can take. And finally, I found this picture of this very interestingly tattooed gentleman, but I'm happy to take any questions. I think we have a few minutes for that.
When it came to the RHPA, with Bill 50 being passed for regulating acupuncture in Ontario, it has gone through, but unfortunately they don't have a regulatory board yet. Until they actually have a regulatory board, we should be keeping up to them. And you would express some concern for occupational health and safety. You might be able to find a lot of links to that with barbers, because it's actually become more common that barbers will contract diseases like Hep B and Hep C from shaving. Also, I want to mention that one thing that's really crucial when referring to piercing, and I find this in so many studies, is that not often enough, they won't differentiate between body piercing and earlobe piercing with a handheld piercing device.
Right.
And that's something that also is something that really needs to be, because when you look deeply at some of these procedures, most of the times the really bad infections are from use of the handheld devices. Units shouldn't be saying that because we're just scaring people. Although it is a pretty common thing when it comes to any bloodborne exposures. But any link to HIV cases through piercing or tattooing would be highly helpful to me.
There is not a lot in the literature, to be honest, but I did find a few cases. I'd be happy to share that with you. Just to go back to your first point, even when there is a regulatory board, I think we've learned, certainly with the College of Physicians and Surgeons, around the hepatitis B outbreak related to EEG in Ontario, that even when there is a regulatory board, there needs to be close work with public health around infection control issues, because they may not have the resources or the expertise to appropriately investigate these things.
Dr. Henry, you talked about wax, using the wax sticks in salons and whatnot, but do you know if there are any guidelines out there that talk about how you take care of the wax baths? And I know that we see the wax baths in physiotherapy clinics and occupational therapy clinics and acute care centers as well. And I've not been able to find, you know, how often you change the wax, or can they even use them safely?
And what temperature you should use.
Exactly.
No, I was not able to find anything. That's a really good point. There's a lot of stuff now, particularly in the U.S., around foot baths and other spa things, but I didn't see anything around wax baths.
With regards to that last question, in the Chica Journal, there is a nice document from the Calgary Public Health. I can't remember which year, but I do have a copy of it. I can share that with you, Paul.
Thank you very much. That's very helpful.
That's great to know, and as the Director of Standards and Guidelines for CHIC, I should have known that, but I'm sorry I didn't.
The Public Health Agency of Canada did issue guidelines for personal services several years ago.
Yes, they did. They're 1990-something or the other. I have them here. They really do lack some detail, though, which is unfortunate, and we are looking at revising those and updating them. They are on the list to be done.
Dr. Henry, I know that you just hours ago came back from a transatlantic flight. You only just stepped off the plane and picked up the phone, so I'm sure that you're very tired. I thank you. You did a wonderful teleclass presentation that you gave, and I'm sure we'll get lots of very nice comments about it. Thank you very much for that.
Well, thank you.
And to everyone who has joined us on this teleclass, I'm glad you have. I hope it was a useful time for you. I'll look forward to spending more time with you in the future. Until then, goodbye.